Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The show in which we learn big banks don't necessarily know better than everybody else. Maybe the most unlikely protest sign you're ever going to see. And another installment of Freakonomics Radio on the show today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Ally Bank, offering IRA savings products and a Raise Your Rate 4-year CD. Learn more at allybank.com. And by CenturyLink, a new kind of broadband company linking Americans coast to coast with consistently fast speeds and personal service. More at CenturyLink.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It's Tuesday, today the 18th of October. Good, as always, to have you with us. Goldman Sachs, the brightest light on Wall Street, the best of the very best. Isn't that what we're told? Well, yeah, except for this past quarter. Goldman reported earnings this morning. It was a loss, a big loss, about $500 million. Other banks have seen their profits hit by the markets, too. J.P. Morgan, Citigroup, the usual suspects. So if the big guns can't handle this market, what hope do the rest of us have? Our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore reports.
If you believe we have nothing to fear but fear itself, you don't have money in a mutual fund. Fear moves stock prices. And all summer and fall, you've seen fear wreck your 401k. Jeff Schwarty manages a stock fund for Principal Global Investors. He says that what makes investing dangerous right now is what Wall Streeters call correlation. We might call it groupthink. It works like this.
When the market's up, almost every stock is up. When the market's down, almost every stock is down.
Schwarty says fear in the market makes it irrational. Bad companies see their stocks rise with the good ones. The market looks broken. Sal Arnick at Themis Trading has seen it too. Arnick says that most small investors usually run for the exits at exactly the wrong time. But he's not surprised. It's hard to have faith in the financial system.
We have a moral duty as participants in the market to make sure that the primary focus of the market is for investing and not gambling and not trading.
Big investors are as worried as the small ones. The market doesn't seem to be working for anybody. And that's hurting even the banks that are supposed to master the markets, like Goldman Sachs. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
The news of Goldman's troubled earnings dovetails nicely with Occupy Wall Street today, specifically with these 45 words that popped up on a protest sign the other day. Bear with me, because it's a mouthful. Here goes. It's wrong, the sign said, to create a mortgage-backed security filled with loans you know are going to fail so that you can sell it to a client who isn't aware that you sabotaged it by intentionally picking the misleadingly rated loans most likely to be defaulted upon. It's clunky, I think we can all agree, not at all protest-like. It's a pretty obscure reference to an infamous Goldman Sachs mortgage-backed security called Abacus, and it was part of a blog post that Connor Friedersdorf wrote on the Atlantic Magazine's website a couple of days ago. Connor, good to have you with us.
Great to be here.
Tell me how this happened. You wrote this post in which it's actually part of a sentence appeared on The Atlantic, and then somebody at Occupy Wall Street basically saw it and put it on a sign, right?
Yeah, the interesting thing is I wrote a post that actually critiqued Occupy Wall Street in a way and said, you know, I wish that they would attack actual Wall Street, the place that helped bring the financial system down, instead of symbolic Wall Street. And I laid out a paragraph that I thought, you know, here's something that actual Wall Street did. And it was just a sentence in my post, and an Atlantic reader took it and put it on a big poster board and took it out into the streets.
And there is a certain beauty because the thing hits basically the same day as Goldman Sachs comes out with earnings. And this post was all about Goldman Sachs and its Abacus deal, which was, as you said in this sentence, a thing where they basically rigged the game in some of these mortgage-backed securities.
It's funny because most people in the streets probably didn't realize that it was the Abacus deal that it was referring to. But I think it tapped into their sense that there are actual things that the investment banks did that were sort of shady practices that were unethical. And they're very complicated. And it's hard to understand exactly what they are. But that sign tapped into the sense of, okay, if that's what it is, yes, that's the kind of thing we're angry about.
Yeah, and that's what really hit me when I read this and I saw the sign and then I read the post you put up about this sign this morning was that there has been so much criticism of Occupy Wall Street for not really having a message, right? They're against a whole bunch of stuff, but not really for anything. And then these 45 words seem to crystallize intensely what it is that's going on out there.
It definitely crystallized it for some people. It's certainly the people that took the couple that took the words and put them on a sign, and some of the people who are chanting it. You know, I think some people are out there for completely different reasons, and this sign probably doesn't appeal to them. But at the same time, there are people out there who really are just angry at what the investment banks did. I think it tapped into the people who are angry about those things.
There's one other thing I wanted to touch base with you about this, and that is the sheer internetness of this entire thing. You wrote a blog post, somebody saw it, they made a sign of what you wrote. You saw a picture of the sign on the web and you wrote about it again. It's very, very, whoa.
Yeah, so I wrote these words from this remote location and someone picked them up and put them on a sign, and a photographer had taken them and put them on his Twitter feed, and someone at Boing Boing saw those. And so there really is a lot of connectedness going on, a lot of internet age going on. It's certainly a story that couldn't have happened before the internet age. And that's one way in which these protests are just different and new and open up different possibilities.
Connor Friedersdorf, he's a staff writer at The Atlantic Magazine. Connor, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner went to Capitol Hill today. He was defending a government jobs program that launched with much promise a year ago. Alas, the execution left much to be desired. Only 15% of the money that was intended to get small businesses hiring actually went out the door. From Washington Marketplace's John Dimsdale explains what happened.
The Small Business Lending Fund was designed as an answer to small businesses that said banks were too scared to lend them money. Congress allocated $30 billion for community banks, which do most of the lending to small businesses. But a year later, only a little over $4 billion was out the door. Geithner says the government was just as skittish as the banks were to lend.
We had to be careful to make sure that the taxpayers' resources were going to banks that were viable. And we were not going to take too much risk.
More than 900 banks jumped at the chance for extra capital, but the government only approved a third of the applications. Banks said between Treasury and their usual regulators they got mixed messages. Tom Broughton, the CEO of Service First Bankshares in Alabama, managed to get a $40 million capital infusion, but he says the bureaucracy didn't make it easy.
My thought is we already have a number of regulators, so what's one more? I already have the State of Alabama Banking Department, I have the FDIC, I have the Federal Reserve, so why not add the Treasury as a regulator?
Despite the botched execution, some lending did result. Broughton says he'll make loans to women, minorities, and veterans who run small businesses around Alabama. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
You remember how yesterday Europe was falling apart, so Wall Street did too? Well, today there are rumors, mind you, of a $2.75 trillion bailout package over there. So, of course, Wall Street's happy. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Time now for a little Freakonomics Radio. It's that moment every couple of weeks where we talk to Stephen Dubner, the co-author of the books and the blog of the same name, joined this week by the other co-author, Stephen Levitt from the University of Chicago. Guys, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kai, how are you?
Good to be here.
Okay, so the topic du jour is cheating, specifically teacher cheating. There have been some big scandals lately in Atlanta and I think in Washington, D.C. And Levitt in Chicago, like 8 or 10 years ago, you actually caught some teacher cheating. So the first question is, based on your experience, can we say how many teachers cheat?
Looking at the data, our estimate at the time, we thought that 5% of all the elementary school classrooms in Chicago showed evidence that the teachers had cheated on behalf of their students on these exams.
Do we know why teachers cheat, Dubner?
Incentives, right? So these days, we've just seen the No Child Left Behind law be scaled back quite a bit.
Yeah,
what's
happened
is states have been given more latitude for how they're going to administer tests. But the fact is if you're a teacher and all of a sudden there's a new incentive in place for you to not do poorly in your class, then teachers all of a sudden have the kind of incentive that students used to have. And so there are some teachers, now granted, it's a very, very small portion of them, who will cheat on behalf of the student, in this case, literally erasing incorrect answers and filling in the correct ones, not necessarily to help the kids, but to help themselves not look like they're bad performers.
Levitt, getting back to Chicago in 2002 and this scandal that you caught, the then guy running the Chicago school system, Arne Duncan, who's now the U.S. Secretary of Education, fired a whole bunch of teachers. Is that still current policy? I mean, if you cheat, you get fired?
Well, I think there are two things you can do if you don't like cheating. One is what Arne did ex post, which is he actually let us really ferret out who the cheaters were, and they went to the trouble to hold the hearings and to fire a bunch of teachers. The other option that's available to policymakers if they really don't like cheating is just to make it harder to cheat. People don't cheat much on the LSAT or the SAT because the companies that provide those tests spend a lot of money and they make it hard to cheat. What school districts now, I think, have an ambivalence towards cheating because they really do want higher test scores. And so they often carry out these tests in ways that it's not hard at all for teachers to cheat. In fact, maybe even subtly encouraged.
But it's that whole spend a lot of money thing, because public schools, as we know, in good parts of this country are out of money. How do you do it in a way that's cost effective?
Well, I think you can even do it without spending money. So, for instance, one thing I proposed to Chicago at the time was that instead of having the teachers in a school administer the testing themselves, you would just have the teachers go to a different school that day and have other teachers come in and administer the test.
Also, with as much money as the Department of Education spends now, Kai, and as high as unemployment is, it's not hard to imagine that you could enact a scenario where you could offer a part-time job. You know, we hire lots and lots of census takers. You know, we could hire some exam proctors at a much, much lower cost. And if it would help get the schools in the shape that we want them to be in, it'd be money well spent.
Not to end on a downer, but this is really the classic Sisyphean task, right? I mean, people are always going to cheat, and you're always going to be behind in ingenuity and ways to combat it, right?
I don't think so. I think this is one problem. Many problems are difficult. This problem is easy. The real problem here is that the people who would have to make those choices and would have to spend that money, they actually don't want cheating to go away that badly. And so I think it's a failure of incentives, not that we don't know how to fight this.
Levitt, you actually tried to start a company offering your catching cheating teacher skills
right?
to school districts around the country.
How did that go?
Nobody was interested. I mean, who wants to buy our product? One person came forward. In East St. Louis, they just reconstituted the entire district. And one of the guys who was on the board said, we'd really like you to come, and we think there might have been cheating. Could you look at the data? And they couldn't get the school. Even the board of the overseeing board could not get the school district. They wouldn't give us the data. So of all the business ideas I ever had, that, I think, ranks at the very bottom in terms of profitable and likely success.
Freakonomics.com is the website. Stephen Levitt and Stephen Dubner, guys, thank you so much.
Talk to you soon, Kai.
And now, let's do the numbers. Hopeful rumors of a European debt relief plan, plus some encouraging economic news here at home, lifted stocks today. The Dow Industrials bounced 180 points, about 1.5%. Closed at 11,577. The NASDAQ rebounded 42 points, nearly 1.75%. 2657 the number. The S&P 500 rallied 24 points, 2%, wrapped up at 1225. Word of a sharp rise in home builder sentiment helped lay a strong foundation for that sector today. Stock in Toll Brothers jumped nearly 13%. Shares of D.R. Horton and KB Home each rose 11%. Bond prices edged lower, though. That nudged the yield on the 10-year T-note up to 2.17%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by IBM, working to help mid-sized businesses become the engines of a smarter planet. Learn more at ibm.com/engines. By Reputation.com, helping small business owners, professionals, and executives monitor, protect, and improve their online reputations. Reputation.com. And by Innocentive, solving important problems for business, government, and foundations by connecting them to problem solvers from around the world. Innocentive.com, where the world innovates. Every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases the Consumer Price Index for September, which measures inflation. In New York, the United Nations Security Council discusses efforts to combat piracy in the Gulf of Guinea. Roll out the red carpet, it's the Attorney General's 59th annual award ceremony. Eric Holder is hosting. I'm Justin Ho.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Imagine, if you can, a place where the labor market is fairly humming along, where the unemployment rate is right around 3%, where if you want a job, you can have a job, where, truth be told, companies are desperate in trying to find people to work. Such a place does exist, you know. We sent Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith to find the secrets of North Dakota's success.
You can tell the second you get there. North Dakota is not like other places. Actually, you can tell before you get there. Flights are really expensive, like whisking off to Paris expensive. And if you can find a hotel room, make that a motel room, it can run as high as $600 a night. Roads and highways are choked with semis. There are "We're hiring" signs everywhere. And you hear a lot of this.
Your Williston Walmart Supercenter is hiring now. Positions are currently
Williston is in the remote northwestern corner of North Dakota. Not a lot out there. The Badlands, rolling waves of grain, and, oh yeah, one of the largest oil resources on the planet, which is pretty much what's behind all the madness.
It took a combination of two 21st century technologies, hydraulic fracturing and horizontal drilling.
Lynn Helms directs North Dakota's Department of Mineral Resources. He says the oil is 2 miles down and locked inside rock. To get it, they use fracking, fracturing the rock and then pushing water through the cracks to extract the oil. They figured out how to apply the technique in North Dakota about 5 years ago.
That changed our largest resource that contains around 400 billion barrels of oil into an economically producible resource for the state.
Oil companies raced to North Dakota, and suddenly Helms went from processing about one oil drilling permit per week to about 20 per day. And every one of those permits means jobs. In the last few years, North Dakota has added 35,000 oil jobs. The state's entire population is only about 630,000, which is why, pretty much overnight, North Dakota found itself dealing with a massive labor shortage. One Halliburton executive even went on Jim Cramer's Mad Money show on CNBC and begged workers to come.
You got a high school education. You can come to work for this organization. If that job will pay $125,000, $130,000 a year.
Now wait a second. You're talking about an unskilled job that could continue.
North Dakota's governor has also done his part.
I say, this is Governor Jack Dalrymple. Would you please come to North Dakota? We have 15,000 job openings in every field imaginable.
North Dakota's tax base is so big, there's money to bolster education and offer incentives to businesses, like property tax exemptions. That's helped attract a Caterpillar manufacturing plant, which will create 250 jobs in Fargo. Amazon's expanding its operation in Grand Forks, which will mean 200 customer service jobs.
North Dakota's probably the biggest industrial project going on in the United States of America right now.
Jim Arthod runs Missouri Basin Trucking in Belfield, North Dakota. Standing in his bustling industrial garage, Arthod says finding workers is a huge challenge. His company spends $10,000 to $12,000 for every new worker he recruits.
We've been to probably half the states on job fairs. It's a full-time job for our human resource team.
Shannon Walker's husband went to one of those job fairs in Michigan and landed a position as an oil truck driver. Shannon got snapped up to work a desk job.
In Michigan, people are on unemployment for 99 weeks at a time because it's so hard to find a job. I was looking for 2.5 years before we came out here. It's wonderful. There's such a big difference. It's just amazing.
If you lose your job here, just walk a block down the road and get another job, you know.
That's Bob Ripka. He works in the oil fields in Williston. He came to North Dakota a few months ago from Minnesota.
I'd say 3/4 of my crew are from Minnesota. And there's a lot of people from Denver. The last three people I met the other day, they're all from Utah, so now they're moving in, you know.
And they all need somewhere to live and eat and shop, which has created a massive construction boom.
This is similar to the California Gold Rush.
Sean Wenko is the Workforce Development Coordinator for the city of Williston. He shows me dozens of ceremonial groundbreaking shovels stacked in the corner of the office. They used to make a special shovel for every groundbreaking, but they've had to go generic because of all the projects.
We have a 700-acre industrial park, which they're actually turning ground on. We have a 300-acre housing complex to the west. We've got a 200-acre retail commercial subdivision, which they will be breaking ground on shortly.
Wanko says the high-paying oil and construction work is making the labor shortage especially hard for lower-paying sectors.
Welcome to McDonald's. How can I help you?
One local McDonald's offers workers a $300 signing bonus. Another pays $15 an hour and is offering a 32-inch flat-screen TV to workers who help recruit. Now, all of this is great for North Dakota, but can this hiring boom be franchised to other states? Governor Jack Dalrymple says yes.
It is about an educated workforce, low taxation, a friendly regulatory climate.
And it doesn't hurt if your state happens to be sitting on 400 billion barrels of oil. In Williston, North Dakota, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Amtrak says 30 million passengers climbed aboard last fiscal year, nearly $2 billion in ticket sales, which sounds pretty good. But the service costs more than that to run, Marketplace's Adrienne Hill reports.
Gas costs a lot these days. The economic downturn has pulled expendable income down with it. And for a lot of people, the desire to just jump in the car doesn't seem as much free-spirited fun as a $60 a tank drag. Joseph Schofer is a professor at Northwestern University.
It's more challenging. It's more difficult financially to travel by automobile.
But those trends have been a plus for Amtrak.
I don't think that paints necessarily a rosy picture for Amtrak, but it sure is encouraging at a point in time when other travel is being pinched.
Sounds pretty rosy to me. What's the problem? For one, if the economy improves, riders might not stick around. Also, Amtrak needs federal money, and Congress is in a cutting mood. Joshua Schenck heads the nonprofit Eno Transportation Foundation.
If you don't subsidize Amtrak, you probably don't have a passenger rail network.
Schenck says passenger rail is a plus for the riders, sure, but it's also good for the environment and the people who do drive. More people on trains mean fewer cars clogging up the evening commute. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
American labor unions and the Occupy crowds are still trying to figure out exactly what their relationship ought to be. Occupy doesn't want to get co-opted. Unions want to tap into the power of the moment. And that's not really far from what's going on in Egypt right now. In Cairo, an organized labor movement that was all but banned under Hosni Mubarak is finding its feet, as Julia Simon reports.
In downtown Cairo, a group of teachers are striking, marching through the streets with big signs. A few weeks ago, it was the post office workers, then the textile workers, the airport employees, nurses. All of them want higher wages. Not far away from this teacher protest is the office of Kamel Abueta. He's a labor activist who was imprisoned and tortured under the Mubarak regime. Today, he runs the Egyptian Federation of Independent Trade Unions.
I'm busy, but the work is sweet. The work is beautiful. We're finally achieving our dream of having independent trade unions here in Egypt.
There's a reason that Abueta uses the word independent. It's not that Egypt never had unions. It's just that before the revolution, most unions were puppets of the regime. Samer Soliman is a professor at the American University in Cairo. He says the government union was created in the 50s to repress the working class.
It was controlled by the state security office, by the secret police, fraud in their elections.
In August, Egypt's new minister of manpower finally started to revamp the government union. Professor Soliman thinks that given the government union's many assets, including a bank and a university, it's in the workers' interest to keep it around. Saber Baraket is on its temporary board.
We have 3 million members. Now we're rebuilding on the principles of democracy. We've gotten rid of the previous leaders and sent them away for public prosecution.
But even if the old leaders get jail time, labor activist Kamel Abbes thinks that the government union is still too corrupt to be reformed.
The fact is, we don't want internal reform of the government union. We want to get rid of it. We want a new federation that represents workers' interests.
An hour south of Cairo, trucks rumble along dusty desert roads carrying workers to their factories. This is the city of Helouan, Egypt's industrial core. Fatih Mustafa has been working at a sugar factory here for 35 years. He says the $80 a month he makes in wages isn't enough to survive.
We want $80 more a month because the cost of everything is going up. The price of food is going up. All we want is our rights, the right to eat, the right to live. That's it. That's all everybody wants.
Regardless of whether Egypt scraps the government union or keeps it, the reality is that there are a lot of workers here who are now looking for a voice. Marian Fadl works for an NGO called the Solidarity Center.
We were having requests coming from everywhere, every day, like hundreds of requests. We had requests from the sugar companies, from the textile companies. We don't have real unions yet. It will take like years and years to just build the whole thing.
Fadl says that's why Egypt's labor activists have to keep up the momentum, fighting for things like a higher minimum wage. Because for many Egyptian workers, the revolution is not over yet. In Cairo, I'm Julia Simon for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation.com, monitoring, protecting, and improving reputations online while deleting personal data from the internet. Reputation.com. And by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, which can properly be filed under the "What the heck does Wall Street know anyway?" label. Apple reported third quarter profits after the closing bell this afternoon, a tidy $6.6 billion straight to the bottom line. Not, though, apparently enough for Wall Street, which sent Apple shares down 8% in after-hours trading on weak iPhone sales. Yeah, that's the same Apple that sold 4 million new iPhones this past weekend. And yes, I know this past weekend doesn't count in last quarter's profits, but come on, those things are like printing money. Wish we could. That's Marketplace from APM American Public Media on this Tuesday. Today, the Dow rallied 180 points, around 1.5%, closed at 11,577, rather. The Nasdaq rebounded 42 points, nearly 1.75%, ended at 2,657. The S&P 500 bounced 24 points, 2%, finished at 1,225. Thanks today to Doug Krisner, Ethan Lindsay, and Jolie Podokas on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you back here tomorrow. This is APM. That's American Public Media.